Good morning. I'm Hale Esfandiari, the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. We have a tradition of co-sponsoring meetings with different programs at the United States Institute for Peace, and we are delighted to co-sponsor this meeting with the Muslim World Initiative at USIP. It's a pleasure, as always, to work with my old friend and colleague, Dan Bromberg. The topic today is very interesting and timely. What makes Zarqawi tick? And we couldn't find a better speaker than Dr. Gilles Kepel, whose book on, may I just look at it, Al-Qaeda dans le texte, was published a few months ago in Paris. Dr. Kepel will speak maybe for 15, 20 minutes, and then we will have Dan Bromberg and Dan Byman commenting. A brief introduction of our speakers, so in order not to interrupt the flow of discussion. Dr. Kepel is the director of the Middle East Mediterranean program at the Sciences Po in Paris, and he's a leading expert and author on the Islamic world. He holds degrees in Arabic, English, and philosophy, and doctorates in sociology and political science. In the 1990s, he was a visiting professor both at New York University and at Columbia University, and he has a number of books, including Jihad, the Trial of Political Islam, and The War for Muslim Minds, Islam and the West. You can't be a student of Islam and not having read all his books. The two commentators, I'll start first with Dan Bromberg, who is an associate professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and a special advisor to the Muslim World Initiative at USIP. His areas of expertise include comparative politics in the Islamic world, third world political development, and the sociology of ideology. He, too, is the author of a great number of publications, articles, and also books. His last book was Reinventing Khomeini, The Struggle for Reform in Iran. As someone who is quite familiar with books written on Iran, this, I can say, is one of the best books that I was published in the last few years.
You must come more frequently.
I usually are not so complimentary. You can ask my colleagues here. Dr. Dan Byman, who is also going to comment on what Gilles Kepel will say, is associate professor and director of the Security Studies Program at the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University's Edmund Walsh School for Foreign Service. He's also a non-resident senior fellow at the Saban Center for the Middle East Policy at the Brookings Institution. He has served as a professional staff member with both the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks on the United States, better known as the 9/11 Commission, and the Joint 9/11 Inquiry Staff of the House and Senate Intelligence Committee. Dan Byman has also worked as the research director of the Center for Middle East Public Policy at RAND Corporation, and among his publications are his latest book, Deadly Dynamics, States That Sponsor Terrorism, which was released in 2005. Gilles Kepel, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Hale, and thank you for inviting me. I'm feeling a little embarrassed and threatened to be speaking between the two Dans, or Bain and Danain. So I don't know what this hides. I'll try to do my best. I was sort of a bewilderment when I discovered the title Dana chosen from me. What makes Sarkawi tick? Because I didn't really have a clear idea what tick meant in colloquial American. So he had to sort of send me a long tafsir, and we'll see if it works or not. So I guess that one of the very interesting things that one can understand about Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi is that with him, in a way, we have reached the sort of long-awaited for desire from the Al-Qaeda leadership to find someone who would mobilize the masses. And if you read back into what I consider is the sort of vastun, or what is to be done, of the Al-Qaeda movement, Ayman al-Zawahiri's booklet, Knights Under the Prophet's Banner, or in Arabic, Fursan Tahta Rayat al-Nabi, published in excerpts by Ashraf al-Awsat, the English, the Arabic language, British-based, London-based newspaper in the end of 2001. Then you have this the statement of anxiety, of political anxiety, in al-Zawahiri's declarations. I mean, we, the vanguard, have been unable to mobilize the masses of the Ummah, Tajish Jamahir al-Ummah. We are the rightful vanguard. The masses are afraid. They do not understand us. And this is why we failed. This is why we failed in the 1990s, in Egypt, in Algeria, in Bosnia, in Kashmir, in Chechnya, what have you. So we have to find a device in order to mobilize the masses. And this device was but 9/11, i.e. using the media to produce some sort of a spectacular, by all means spectacular, shockwave that would then convince the masses that the enemy was weak, and not only the nearby enemy, Adu al-Qarib, i.e. The powers that be in the Muslim world, but more so the faraway enemy, Adu al-Ba'id, i.e. the U.S., who is the backer of the local regimes. And by sort of exposing the Achilles heel of the faraway enemy, then Zawahiri believed, then the masses would suddenly discover that there was no need to be afraid, and that they could join the ranks of the vanguards and join the ranks of jihad and topple the powers that be. As you all know, this is not exactly what happened after 9/11. And Al-Qaeda, whatever we call Al-Qaeda, but we have no time in the 9 minutes I have left to define Al-Qaeda at length, Al-Qaeda was unable to sort of develop from vanguard terrorist martyrdom operation group into mass movement, or into a movement that would mobilize the masses. And they were compelled, in order to show that they were still in existence, to perform all those copycat bombings in 2002, 2003, 2004, up to 2005, and lastly the London bombings of last summer. But this did not lead anywhere in terms of the goal that was sought after, i.e. the mobilization of the masses and the toppling of the powers that be. Only in Iraq did it finally happen. Only in Iraq, after U.S. and allied invasion and the toppling of the Saddam regime in the spring of 2003, where Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi and his group managed to join forces with Sunni insurgents. And in a way, this joining of forces was, after a while, defined or claimed as the work of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, which for that occasion took the sort of new name of the local branch, if you wish, the local franchise, took the name of Qaeda al-Jihad fi bilad al-Rafidain, i.e., literally translated, the base for jihad in the country of the two rivers, of the Mesopotamia. And Zarqawi had a life before Iraq, as you know. He was born in Jordan. His name is not Zarqawi, it's his pseudo, and relates to the city of Zarqa, from which he is originary. And he had fought in Afghanistan already during the first Afghan jihad wars, then came back to Jordan, was put in jail, got very close to a very important advocate for jihad who's under semi-liberty in Jordan, called Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi, who's a very useful person because he is the sort of internet encyclopedia of jihad. I mean, his website is the place where you go to see whether a jihadi text is, if I may say so, kosher or not. Because if it's on tawhid.ws, it's kosher for Passover. If not, you should have doubts. And Abu Muhammad al-Maqdisi is probably the person who was the most influential on Zarqawi, because Zarqawi himself is not an ideologue by any means. He probably reads and writes a little, but he definitely hasn't written the text that he has signed. The text he signed, and one of the most famous of them, is the one that was found on by Kurdish soldiers or Peshmergas on one of his envoys in early 2004. Exposing his strategy of attacking Shias, was most probably written by another intellectual who's close to them, who was killed on September 2004 on an attack on the infamous Abu Ghraib prison, Abu Anas al-Shami. So, it so happened that after he was freed from jail in Jordan on the occasion of King Abdullah's coming to power, who had a general amnesty for prisoners, Zarqawi then went back to Afghanistan and lately to Iraq through the Kurdish Ansar al-Islam groups, where he finally joined forces after the invasion of spring 2003 with the Sunni insurgents. As I said, there you have the first opportunity for Al-Qaeda to be grounded on a turf, i.e. not to plan bombings or executions or whatever through a little group of people who are either planted in a country or who come and leave, but really to sort of achieve this goal that Zawahiri has indicated, i.e. mobilize the masses by virtue of example. Mobilize the masses so that they would topple the unjust state or the unjust ruler or the impious powers that be or what have you. And this is very different, if I may say so, from the situation in Palestine, where in Palestine you also had a number of suicide bombings that were carried by religious groups, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and also by other groups, by secular groups. But never ever was Al-Qaeda able to to set a toe into the Islamic, the Palestinian-Israeli jihad process. I mean, this was kept, this was a process that was kept under control by the local Islamic and non-Islamic movements, and they definitely did not want to be hostage to the vested interests of the Al-Qaeda leadership. And this is something we can discuss later, of course, which has led, in a way, to the transformation of violent operations into the voting of Hamas into parliament, lastly. In Iraq, it's quite different. Then Sunni insurgents needed the Al-Qaeda activists and vice versa. And this created the sort of the first place where you had a blend between the two. But this blend is in itself a problem. It is a problem because, in a way, when you look at it from a distance, or when you look at it, say, in 2004, when it sort of started, it looks like the Al-Qaeda guys were able to sort of sell their propaganda and their worldview to the local Sunnis, and that the reason they were so popular, so well entrenched, particularly in Fallujah, was that they were the uncompromising adversaries of the U.S. military and of U.S. occupation. And not only did they rely on local forces, but they also created a new magnet for jihad in the area. Iraq now being what Afghanistan was in the 1980s, if you wish, where you have young people from the Arab world going usually through Syria or through Saudi Arabia, or at times through Jordan and Kuwait also, rarely from Iraq, through Iran, to Iraq in order to die there. And in France, among other places, the police has arrested a number of kids from Paris, from North African origin, who were volunteers for Iraq. At least two were reported dead in suicide operations. Plus, there was this famous story in Europe of this Belgian young lady, a former drug addict, and someone who sold cakes in a bakery, who was Belgian-born, converted to Islam, and finally with her husband, Moroccan husband, drove a Mercedes all from Charleroi to Baghdad to blow the Mercedes up in front of the U.S. convoy. So this has created this new field for jihad, new magnet for jihad in the area, and in a way it is something that plays the same role as Afghanistan in the 1980s. For instance, when we think of Saudi Arabia, one of the reasons for which the casualties, the number of casualties in Saudi Arabia went down significantly over the last 2 years, was not only that the Saudi police was finally able to track down a number of insurgents, but also that they were all sent to Iraq. Just like, you know, Afghanistan in the old days was the place where activists from Algeria, from Egypt, and from other places were sent with the blessing of the police. You know, go there, get lost, blow yourself up and die for Allah if you wish, but, you know, get out of the way. And but the difference, of course, is that in the old days of Afghanistan, jihad was blessed by the U.S., whereas this is an anti-U.S. jihad. Or is it? Because there was a price to pay for Zawahiri's alliance with the Sunni insurgents. And this price was that the targets were not only the Americans or the infidels or the empire's rulers, but also and mainly, if we can judge in terms of the number of people killed, fellow Iraqis, the so-called heretics, Rafida or Shias, Rafida in Zarqawi's vocabulary. And one very significant contribution, original contribution of Zarqawi's to the Al-Qaeda prose, as we sort of showed in this reader of Al-Qaeda, which we published in French, something that the neocons will decide is another proof of the fact that French are on the wrong side. Something which is very clear is that nowhere, neither in Abdallah Azzam's texts, nor in Zawahiri's, nor in Bin Laden's text, is there any reference made to the Shias. And they are not interested in it. It's not part and parcel of their goals. Whereas Zarqawi's texts are obsessed with Shias, with the fact that Shias are traitors, they are stooges of the Americans, friends of the Jews, and that they should be killed first and foremost, and that they are the most dangerous people in the world, and that Islam cannot succeed unless Shias are exterminated. Now, this is okay when you are, you know, part and parcel of the groups of Sunni insurgents who are interested in having the biggest share of power at the end of the day in the U.S.-sponsored or in the post-U.S. Iraqi government. And the more you put pressure on the Shias, the more you kill them, then they will finally yield and give the Sunnis, I don't know, one-third or one-tenth or one-fourth or one-half of oil and of power whenever oil flows back into Iraq. But in the meantime, this is something that is detrimental to Al-Qaeda's message, because in a way, in doing so, Zarqawi has become a tool in the hands of Sunni, Iraqi Sunnis, and is just doing their politics. He's just a killer for hire, but he has forgotten the sort of universal objectives or goals of Al-Qaeda, which is global jihad. If I may say so, Zawahiri is the Trotsky of Al-Qaeda, with, you know, it's jihad in the world, whereas Zarqawi is a sort of low times Stalin of jihad in one country. And this jihad in one country is also something which becomes hostage there again of the vested interest in the Sunnis. So he has his mass mobilization, Jamahir al-Ummah, you know. But nevertheless, the problem is that it's not for the right cause. And that explains why you had this letter that Nick published, and from Zawahiri to Zarqawi, there were controversies on whether this letter was authentic or not. I mean, knowing to some extent my Zawahiri, I would tend to say that it sounds like it, as the Italian have it. Se non è vero, è ben trovato. It's well crafted. Congratulations to Nick if they did it. But it looks true. And then Zawahiri attacks him on that and says, you know, stop this fuss with the Shias, because instead of pursuing universal jihad, you're into fitna, you're into sedition, you're into internecine fighting between Muslims, and this is not going to lead to our success. This is going to lead to another failure. And what's this business with beheadings on webcam? You think this is going to give us publicity, but this is too much. You know, on the contrary, this is frightening people, and we look like monsters. We don't look like the rightful vanguard, and it's extremely bad. And actually, the televised execution stopped after in 2005. So, in a way, Zarqawi is at a crossroads, and the Zarqawi, whatever Zarqawi means, I mean the Zarqawi meaning in this case the Al-Qaeda operatives in Iraq. As you all know, and definitely much better than I do, there was an attempt for rapprochement between Sunnis and American authorities, and Ambassador Khalilzai and others have been very clear on that, and Muslim Brothers, Sunni Muslim Brothers in Iraq were welcome to take part in the last electoral process that led to the parliamentary elections, and that was an attempt by the U.S. to sort of bring back the Sunnis into the fold and to try to cut the Sunni, the good fighting Sunni elements from the bad Zarqawi activists. This was, of course, something that would become extremely dangerous for the Zarqawi guys, because it would cut their mass base, in a way. And it would also play into what is Al-Qaeda's nightmare, that is to say that, once again, the Muslim Brothers, those traitors in the blood of martyrs, I mean, it's not me, of course, it's Zawahiri speaking, are going to get an upper hand. And it was not lost on Zawahiri how favorably the U.S. press covered the good democratic Muslim Brothers who were candidates in Egypt against the corrupt elements of the regime. And you know, you had an infuriated reaction from Zawahiri to the Muslim Brothers' victory in Egypt, or victory wherever they were candidates. Also a very violent attack on Hamas recently. And the same was true with Iraq. So, to Zawahiri, these politics are going to lead the Muslim Brothers, his arch enemies, to sort of reap the benefits of the jihad that the radicals have implemented, which is one of the dangers that he sees and that he wants to avoid at all costs. So, due to this this problem in the after the elections, after the participation of Sunnis in the elections, then you had the last episode with which I will conclude, because I see Hadi and Dan, looking at me with anxiety.
I would have sent you a note. Go ahead.
Okay, fine. Okay, I conclude.
You received the note already.
Okay, fine. I'll conclude. That led to the destruction of the Samarra Dome on the 22nd of last month. Which is something which is a major attack on the sanctity of Shias, and the destruction of the dome was something that unleashed Shia forces, and that led to those massacres, which are, if it's not a civil war, it looks like it, where every night you find tens of Shias who were killed at random in a place, and the other night you have tens of Sunnis, and so on and so forth. Something which is making the possibility of a coalition government even more remote, because Sunnis, there again, are not willing to get into that. And now, to what extent is this finally a victory or not or a temporary victory for the Al-Qaeda and the Zarqawi strategy? It seems clear that it will be difficult after the Samarra bombing to co-opt Sunni leaders significantly into the governing Iraqi body. And also, it opens another avenue for anxiety in Iraq. I guess that the U.S., even though it was difficult, could do with one enemy only, i.e. Sunni insurgents, as long as they could count on the Kurds. But the Kurds are more and more secluded from, even though there are Kurds in Baghdad, of course, but, you know, Kurdish territory is more and more becoming a sort of autonomous republic. And mainly counting on the support of Shias. But nowadays, with factions within the Shias taking arms and killing Sunnis and having their own policy being helped to this regard, in this regard, by Iranian forces under Ahmadinejad, it may look like the U.S. will have to face two enemies. Because the basis for support within Iraqi Shias is definitely dwindling now. Dwindling because the Iranian, the influence of Iran, is making itself felt more and more. And while you have Shias who lash out for revenge against Sunnis, then you'll have to have the U.S. forces act in protection of Sunnis. And this was already clear in the last declarations of Ambassador Zalmay Khalilzad, saying that he did not want that police forces be under sectarian control and so on and so forth, meaning the Ministry of Interior. So this, in a way, tells us that as of now, the Al-Qaeda system in Iraq was sort of, in my view, able to overcome the dangers and the challenges it faced. At first, they sort of joined forces with the Sunnis, and they had their mass following. Finally, somewhere. Then there was this problem that, you know, they were being taken hostage by the vested interests of the Sunnis, and the global jihad thing was disappearing. And then, because of the attempt of the U.S. administration in Iraq to separate the insurgents from Zarqawi, the brutal provocation against the Shias nowadays have managed finally to make the Shias come down into the battle and fight against the Sunnis. And in that, even though Zarqawi is not a mere player, first rank player, nevertheless, this is going to lead to a situation where U.S. forces are caught between a rock and a hard place, or between Iran and a hard place, if you will. It is not for certain that Zarqawi and Al-Qaeda are so enthusiastic at the growing role of Iran in Iraq. But there again, their first objective is to see U.S. Troops leave, or at least suffer a number of casualties. In Zawahiri's letter to Zarqawi, I mean, he's foreseeing the pullout of America from Iraq, more or less on the lines of the pullout from Vietnam, where, you know, where they will leave their allies around and so on and so forth. But the this is where I think we could go as of today. I mean, I guess that the Zarqawi guys, I don't know what makes him tick or not, but the answer's for you. But the definitely they managed to set fire to a situation where the U.S. is in a very difficult position, but where there is another major player who's making inroads into Iraq, which is Iran, which is part of the heretics or the Rafida, from whom Zarqawi and company may have to fear more even maybe than the U.S.
Thank you very much. Dan,
okay.
10 minutes.
Okay, well, I'll be very brief. I thanks very much, Hale, for joining us again in another event co-sponsored with the Woodrow Wilson Center and USIP, the Muslim World Initiative. I have to say that I've been to Paris a number of times and lectured with Gilles and taught a little bit, and always wished my French was quite as good as Gilles's English. It was a very interesting presentation. And the book itself, I understand, is going to be translated and published by Harvard. Is that correct? It's extremely interesting because when you read it, you get a sense of this theme of fitna, of the ideological divergences within the within Al-Qaeda, and it does provide a set of insights into a movement which, as Gilles points out in the introduction of the book, is often presented in very obviously simplistic terms in the media. So it is very useful to read, and I'm glad that it's going to be translated into English. I just want to say a couple of things that struck me about the section on Zarqawi, the piece on the Shia attributed to him, or perhaps written by others, but attributed to him. By the way, you know, the Zarqawi ticks, and my wife looked at me and said, that's an interesting double entendre. I hadn't thought about it until, believe it or not, until we put it out there. But in any case, reading Zarqawi's piece is kind of a Mein Kampf on Shia. It's quite striking, the virulent hatred he displays towards the Shia in that particular tract. And I wondered, reading it, you get a sense that, well, in part, this hatred is a matter of principle. It's ideological, if you like, or perhaps even in some strange way, philosophical. But it's also clearly tactical, and he has a tactical purpose, and he explains it quite clearly. He says that, you know, if democracy triumphs and the Shia triumphs, well, we will not be able to do anything because they will have triumphed democratically by the vote, and our job is to prevent that by creating the civil war. And so you get a sense of the very interesting relationship between principle and tactics here. But you got to wonder, reading that, whether this ideology of hatred vis-a-vis the Shia, who he says are not only, by the way, in collaboration with the Jews, but who in some sense have been invented by the Jews, which is a new twist on that theory. You got to wonder whether, in fact, the Iraqi Sunni insurgents, and I'm not an expert on this issue, but are not necessarily ideologically or philosophically opposed to the Shia. This is a matter of power. This is a matter of a power dispute. But whether, in fact, Zarqawi's message of principled hatred, let's put it that way, becomes something that is then becomes widespread in the Sunni community, not only in Iraq but further afield, and that really means undermining in some sense the world Islamic revolution principle of Al-Qaeda. It's quite striking. You wonder whether if you go from practice to praxis, if you like, from tactic to philosophy, and this becomes ingrained, what the consequences will be. It's quite striking. The other thing that struck me about reading, particularly the section on Zarqawi's background and his ideology, the thing that struck me was his disdain for Iraqis, his disdain for the ulama, which is, of course, as Gilles mentioned, the clerics, but also just your average Iraqi. There's very little out there with whom he feels any kind of basic trust in the milieu that he's operating. This is not in any sense unusual for a kind of vanguard ideology. We've seen this on the left as well, where you speak in the name of the masses, and yet at the same time you sort of disdain the masses. Zarqawi's attitude towards the average Iraqi seems to be quite negative, and I wonder, in that sense, how this evolution of this very interesting alliance is going to, where this interesting evolution is going to move forward. So those were sort of the two things that struck me in reading the text. I think I'll leave it at that and turn turn the mic over to my colleague, Dan Bynum. Thank you.
Thank you. It's a great honor to be up here. Dr. Capel is one of the people who I think clearly writes more than I read, and granted I read quite slowly, but even so, his ability to churn out extremely high-quality works never ceases to amaze me. A reading of his works reveals at times an occasional amusement with American scholars of terrorism and counterterrorism. Admittedly, this is a bit like shooting fish in a barrel. However, I think I'm supposed to give the perspective of the fish at the moment, so I will do so because I am certainly not a scholar of political Islam. I want to talk about four points that occurred to me as Dr. Capel was speaking. The first is the idea of the vanguard. And for anyone who follows terrorism, you know that that is almost universal among terrorist groups, is the idea of seeing themselves as a vanguard. And there are two vanguard approaches, though, and it's very important to think of them quite separately. One is the idea that by this deed, by what old Russian revolutionaries called propaganda of the deed, you know, we shall strike, we shall show the weakness of the strait, and, you know, huzzah, the masses will rise. A quite different approach is we shall strike, the state will strike back. And that will get people to hate the state. And huzzah, the masses will rise. But one implies that success is in the hands of the terrorists directly. The other requires exploiting the enemy, in this case governments around the world, to act. And they have very different policy implications. And you need to think about what the terrorists are trying to accomplish with this, because in general, one frustration that terrorists share almost universally is the masses don't seem to want to rise. They don't quite recognize the brilliance of the revolution, whatever its idiom. And this is a problem that Marxist revolutionaries had. It's a problem that ethno-nationalist revolutionaries have, and so on. We tend to see terrorist groups as successful. But you must remember that 90% of them are wiped out within a year or two. So the vast majority of terrorist groups, you know, they're five guys sitting in a cafe. They blow something up. They go to jail or die. And it's over. They fail again and again. The ones we focus on, however, are that small group that have had some measure of success. A second point I'd like to raise is the idea of how much ideology matters, and I think more importantly, when it matters. It's, to me, inherently interesting, but that doesn't necessarily tell you much. I actually find biblical criticism quite interesting, but I'm not going to tell you that's going to be something that everyone should be concerned about on a day-to-day basis. Clearly, ideology is a tool. It's a tool for recruitment. It's a tool for inspiring your followers. But it's an open question to me how much of a guide it is toward a group's action. If you go back and you look at some of the one of the first suicide bombings by a Sunni jihadist group, which is an attempted assassination of an Egyptian government official in Egypt by Islamic Jihad, and the double backflips the group had to go through to rationalize the suicide bombing. And they ended up dragging in Christian martyrs and talking about the importance of martyrdom. And if you're a radical Islamist group reduced to talking about Christian martyrdom, you know you really have a ways to go. And this shows to me that for many of these groups, it's pragmatism that is driving them, not ideology when it comes to the choices of their attacks. But unfortunately, it's not that easy to dismiss ideology. In addition to the recruitment and mobilization function, it often leads groups to make huge mistakes from a strategic point of view. And one of the best examples of that is Algeria, where I think for ideological reasons, in the mid-1990s, parts of the movement turned the country into a slaughterhouse. And as a result, the worldwide jihadist movement kind of recoiled and, in a way, created new groups to go for this. But it was a tremendous weakness, and I think many of us who were watching Algeria in the mid-1990s were very concerned that this government was going to fall. And I think the insurgents, through their own ideological incompetence, really gave the government a shot in the arm, that it took a lot to make the Algerian government look better than the alternative, but they succeeded. The third point I'd like to raise is the question of Zarqawi himself. The United States, as is well known, has quite a reward for his head. But it is always an interesting question to me, which is, if you remove a leader, let us say he is magically killed tomorrow, does something better come in his place? And I would say for bin Laden, he's a very unusual leader, quite gifted in a number of ways. Zarqawi, actually, I don't think is a particularly good insurgent leader. And I would be quite concerned that his replacement might be more effective. There's a certain matter of justice to me that wants me to have his head on a pole, perhaps quite literally. But that's quite different from whether this is actually a good thing for fighting the insurgency. And this is someone who has divided the insurgency. This is an insurgent movement that was really a bottom-up phenomenon. For those of you who, like me, were in the world of studying ethnic conflict and civil unrest in the 1990s, you know that we focus very much on leaders. You know, how do leaders manipulate masses? How do they create this phenomenon where hatred did not exist? This one really seemed to be bottom-up. You know, the old line about the man chasing the crowd and saying, wait for me, I'm your leader. I mean, that seemed to be happening in Iraq where leaders did emerge, but they were not driving the driving force. But Zarqawi has divided the anti-American movement. He's divided the Sunni movement, for that matter. And he's made the cause exceptionally unpopular through, he's made the cause less popular than it should be through a series of tactics, as were mentioned, such as the public beheadings and so on, that have really caused a lot of problems for him in a way that suggests that his competence as a leader, to me, is an open question. The last point I'd like to talk about is this question of when local insurgencies go global that Dr. Capel raised at the end of his talk. This was something that the movement tried in Bosnia, where you had a strong local movement where they tried to flood foreign fighters in and shift the ethos of the movement and failed quite disastrously. Kashmir, however, it has succeeded to a degree, where you have a number of groups that are either heavily influenced by fighters who are not Kashmiri, whether Pakistani Kashmiri or Indian Kashmiri, or who are drawn from really outside the immediate conflict. And while this it creates a number of quite effective fighters and bodies to throw into something, it's actually quite dangerous for the cause in general. If you are a local insurgent leader, there are real risks to this. One is that these people tend to be much less discriminate in who they kill because, as Professor Brumberg mentioned, they often have contempt for the locals. You know, after all, they're lazy, they're not fighting, I can kill them. You know, they're takfir, on and on. The other is that you hurt nationalism. Most effective insurgencies harness nationalism in some way. We see this in Iraq, where they may have an ideology that involves, you know, power to the people. It may involve Islam, but it tends to work when you get people motivated against an outsider, or you get people thinking that the government is not legitimate. But when you drag in foreign fighters of your own on your own side, nationalism can work in favor of the government. It really does hurt the insurgent movement. And that, to me, is why very smart groups tend to shy away from this. If you look at what Hamas has done, Hamas has, from what I understand, cleaned out a number of Palestinian camps of various al-Qaeda figures and some of the ones it controls. And it's quite concerned that its own movement will be hijacked because it wants to use violence, but use it pragmatically. It thinks strategically and doesn't want violence simply to go off the rails because it recognizes that's quite dangerous for Hamas's pursuit of power. It's not necessarily because it's a gentle movement, but simply because it's a smart one. I want to close simply by saying one of the things I've admired most about Dr. Capel's work is that it gives me a tremendous sense of hope, because there's a tendency in especially Washington policy circles to see the enemy, as it were, as a evil monolith, and you're kind of waiting for thousands of fighters to pour into the streets of Washington and set off bombs and so on. But when you read his writings, you understand the divisions and the differences within this movement, their problems, their weaknesses. And that actually suggests a long-term strategy, which is time. You know, there's a question, and this was the heart of, you know, the containment of communism, which is, do certain movements have shelf lives? And do they collapse inherently of their own contradictions? And I think no smart person ever bets on that. But you have to recognize when you're thinking about this movement that too much of a direct attempt to influence this may actually prolong it, rather than the goal, which should be exacerbating current and inherent weaknesses, which is this movement in a very broad sense is quite susceptible for. I'm seeing the French cover of the book, and there are four names on the cover: Bin Laden, Azam, Zawahiri, and Zarqawi. And with the Zawahiri Bin Laden exception, Bin Laden formed al-Qaeda in part because he rejected where Azam was taking the organization. It was a splinter movement. Zarqawi has been quite resistant, as was said, to parts of the al-Qaeda agenda. there are huge differences within this movement, and that's something that needs to be recognized and ideally exploited. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'd like to open the floor. Could I ask you to go to the microphone and identify yourself also and your affiliation, please? Usually there are two mics. Okay.
Trudy Rubin from, Trudy Rubin from the Philadelphia Inquirer. I'd like to ask about this difference between nationalism and al-Qaeda's broader philosophy. I'd like to ask Gilles Kepel, inside the Sunni movement in Iraq, as you know, there was the beginnings of an effort actually to combat Zarqawi, which seemed to be gaining a little bit of traction, even though some of the sheikhs involved in it were being murdered. Do you see that movement to repel the foreigners as something that could gain momentum, or do you think that the civil strife that was fomented by the Golden Mosque bombing is likely to interfere with the growth of that? And I'd like to ask Dan Byman, do you think that if the peace process really is dead in Israel and the Palestinian issue, that the effort to keep al-Qaeda out of the Palestinian movement could end, and when you got nothing, you've got nothing to lose, Hamas could change their mind?
Yes, please. Trudy, you can take it.
I guess that the Golden Dome operation is clearly very detrimental to the co-option of Sunni elites, and particularly Sunni Muslim Brother elites, into the government. And that's, in a way, the sort of sectarian violence is now becoming more important than the feeling that there is a common nationhood you have to fight for against your foreign helpers, be they from Syria, from Algeria, or from the suburbs of Pittsburgh or Paris. For the time being, I would say that the sort of the attempt that was made to have the Sunnis, you know, join the bandwagon, and so that, you know, at the end of the day, they would get a chunk out of the oil resources when they start flowing back. This has been really jeopardized by the Golden Dome bombings, and the more Shia Sunni strife there is, the more Iranian involvement you're going to have. And I guess that now the Iraqi issue is going to be more and more a mixed Iraqi-Iranian issue, which makes things even more difficult for the present American presence.
Dan?
Very briefly, I think that there's a long way to go before Hamas would embrace al-Qaeda for a number of reasons. One is, as we've learned in the Israeli-Palestinian dispute, things can always be worse. In fact, when you say those words, it's like saying, you know, at least it's not raining. You look out when you say things could not be worse, because they have gotten much worse and certainly could. And Hamas is probably the first group to recognize that possibility. I would also add that there's tremendous, you know, within this community, there's tremendous hostility, as was mentioned, between the Muslim Brotherhood and other parts of the broader Salafi jihadist movement. And the Muslim Brotherhood is suspect for a variety of reasons. Its willingness to participate in politics, it's part of its organizational structure. There are a number of reasons, but remember, of course, that Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood spinoff, and that there's similarities to this. what I would be more concerned about is actually almost the converse of this, which is we've seen a number of groups, when they've been defeated locally, going global. It's a very odd reaction when you think about it, which is, I have failed to achieve jihad in Egypt. I have failed to achieve jihad in Algeria. Therefore, I'm going to attack the United States. But there's actually a tactical logic to it. Because these groups are organizations and must continue to function, it's often too hard for them to function in the countries where they're being hit hard. And going global is, in a way, tactically easier for them. And what is fascinating, we have letters from bin Laden to Egyptian leaders in the mid-1990s saying basically, every time you attack a target in Egypt, you lose 100 people in the aftermath of the attack. They're arrested, they're wrapped up, and so on. And what do you gain? On the other hand, the United States is wide open. And if Hamas both does get the sense that, you know, there is no hope through other means and gets the sense that it's the fault of the United States, I would worry that some elements of Hamas, in particular its foreign branches operating in Europe, would start to strike at U.S. targets. One thing European services are quite concerned about is that, those of you who are fans of the Steven Spielberg movie Munich, you know that for parts of the 1970s and 1980s, Europe was a battleground between Israeli services and Palestinian groups. That could renew, that you could see Europe again being a theater, in part because Israel has effectively shut down a lot of what's happening in the Palestinian areas through quite effective intelligence, and because there is a Palestinian presence that's used right now mainly for fundraising, but could easily be turned into a small operational network.
Yes, please.
Thank you. Alec McRae, Media Development Associates. My question is for Dr. Keppel, and it's a very brief three-part question. First, operationally speaking in military terms, how does Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda organization interface with the indigenous Sunni Arab insurgents? The second part is, how many of Zarqawi's Al-Qaeda organization, the core organization, are non-Iraqis, for example, Saudis, Egyptians, Chechens, Pakistanis, and so forth? And the third part of the question is, did Zarqawi's organization promote and, in a sense, teach the methodology of suicide bombing to the local Iraqi Sunni insurgents?
You can take a seat. Pardon me? Wait for the answer. Sit down, please.
Well, thank you. If I were in a position to answer accurately your questions, I would not be sitting here, but probably in some place in the green zone of Baghdad leading the operations. I mean, no one really knows, you know, how it functions precisely. What you have is that you have to rely on intelligence sources, which are not always reliable, and on the documents which you can access to mainly via the internet, in terms of wills of martyrs or pre-recorded wills of martyrs, there are quite a lot actually. And if you have Arabic, and you have an Arabic search, whatever it's called, engine, on the internet, then you regularly have access to biographies or hagiographies of so-called martyrs who died blowing themselves up in Iraq. And following that sample, it looks quite clear that a very significant amount of people who blow themselves up in Iraq are not Iraqis. As I mentioned before, there is a very significant Saudi contingent, and Saudis are particularly sought after because they, when they come to the Iraqi border, I mean, they have, you know, a large amount of pocket money for their daily expenses, which their fixers confiscates for jihad use, and so they're particularly popular. They are also popular in Saudi Arabia amongst some of the people in charge of security, because, you know, the more you send those guys to Iraq to blow themselves up, the less they will remain in Saudi Arabia. I mean, this is something that was already experimented in the 1980s with the jihad in Afghanistan thing. So, and we have testimonies and wills from people from Europe, from Syria, Algeria, and the like, who blew themselves up. So it looks like there is a significant amount of foreign martyrs who are there, and as soon as they would be martyrs, as soon as they have crossed the border, they have nothing left. I mean, except their relation with the organization which is going to send them to their death, right? And even though some have escaped, you know, and we have at times you have interviews with so and so who finally didn't do the job and escaped, and but the majority of the people who go there are there for the job, and they put themselves in a situation where they will not do anything else. Now, so to what extent do Iraqis themselves blow themselves up? There are some, but it's, I mean, in terms of numbers, it's not very well documented. I mean, amongst other things, because the websites who are keen to post the wills usually are websites which are one way or another linked with a group operating in one country. For instance, the Saudi jihadi websites are keen to have the lists of Saudi martyrs, the Syrian martyrs, and so on and so forth. So your first question was to what extent?
What extent operationally does Zarqawi's Al Qaeda organization interface with the indigenous Iraqi insurgents? Do they work together in operationally or separately?
Well, there again, if I were able to answer, I would not be staying here. But I mean, yeah. But what was probably the best case in point in terms of the where we have knowledge, Fallujah, where in Fallujah you had indigenous Iraqi fighters, local tribes, and the like, together with a number of Zarqawi people, and a number of them were killed or were found in Fallujah. What comes out of this picture, of this blurred picture, is that in a way you have two layers, i.e. that the Zarqawi people are performing a number of operations which are not only for their own sake, but for the sake of the Sunni insurgents in general, i.e. Trying to hamper Shia interests in the government per se. And this is precisely where the U.S. is trying to be active, I mean, to try to differentiate the two and to show to the local Sunni, even if they're insurgents, that what the Zarqawi people are doing is against their interests as Sunnis.
If I may just add a quick word, you know, this issue, which is very difficult to answer, raises the broader question of what, ultimately, at the end of the day, do the Sunnis have an interest in the civil war in Iraq? And I think the answer is, if their goal is to use violence for political purposes, the answer is no, because they can't prevail in the civil war. Particularly, as you will point out, if the Iranians intervene, look at the forces allied against them. So ultimately, what is Zarqawi up to? What does he really want? Maybe he doesn't care. Maybe his basic goal is to have mayhem. But the goal of the Sunnis is to find some way of affecting the political climate. So this is a very profound fissure. Now, we may have crossed the line already on that issue, in which case, the Sunnis may find themselves on the losing end. So I think this is, in some sense, a more fundamental question in terms of what ultimately, in terms of the kinds of fissures that Gilles talked about and extent to which they can be exploited. I think we're probably beyond that already.
Gilles, did you want to add something?
Yeah, maybe not on al-Zarqawi per se, because there again, I mean, as Dan just mentioned, it's difficult to know whether there is any significant Zarqawi ideology. I mean, Zarqawi is somewhere between the al-Qaeda ideology and the day-to-day management of jihad on the ground. But if we go back to Zawahiri's letter to Zarqawi, released last fall, Zawahiri says that jihad in Iraq has different steps. First step, to oust the Americans. Second step, creates an Islamic Emirate in Iraq and then reinforce it so that it would become a caliphate on the biggest amount of territory possible, first in Iraq and then in surrounding countries. Third step, sort of widen the jihadist wave, as he says, to the secular countries who are neighbors to Iraq. And fourth step, which is the final step, fight Israel and destroy Israel. So, you know, but this is a very, if I may say, a very naive Sunni view of the situation in the area. Because, you know, you have a big man nearby who's Mr. Iran, and this one has different interests, right?
My name is Rick Marshall. I work for USAID. This is precisely the question I wanted to ask you, and I'll see if I can draw you out a little bit more. It's certainly conceivable that Iraq could go into a much more violent situation and perhaps be a genuine civil war. The United States might even pull out under certain circumstances. But is there any sense that that this is a winnable fight? That do they have a plan or a sense, a tactical plan, where they actually could prevail given the numbers, at least within Iraq? Excuse me, or is it really a general Muslim worldwide conflagration that would have to take place?
Who's the they?
This is al-Qaeda.
Oh.
If they're going to go against the Shia, they're obviously not going to be allied with the Kurds. So, you're going to have huge numbers against you to begin.
Okay. Going back to what Dan Bromberg said earlier on, why is it that Sunni insurgents had an interest in insurgency? I guess that, you know, they considered that what they would get out of the new sort of pro-American power system in Iraq would be close to zero in terms of the chunk of oil they would get, in terms of the access to power. So if they had an insurgency going on, there would be no oil at all. So, you know, even if they had nothing, it would be zero divided by nothing, and the others would have nothing also. So the bargain was that we'll stop the insurgency provided we can have a deal which is satisfactory to us, and then, you know, we'll start bargaining. And this was, in my view, this finally was understood by the U.S. side, and this is why Khalil Zai opened to the Sunnis, and their co-option into the system meant that they would get something significant out of the deal. And that is, or that was, maybe it's too late now, but that is the only way for the U.S. to have a stabilized situation in Iraq. Even though the Sunnis are a minority, they nevertheless have a powerful nuisance, if I may say so, which can preclude any return to peace, to stability, and to wealth and well-being in Iraq. So you'd better have them in. Then you have to decide on what's the level of their participation. But with the Samarra bombings, it looks like, you know, it's going to be extremely difficult, and that they are not going to the stakes are going to be much higher from the Sunni side in terms of their participation to power.
Let me chime in on that.
I mean, Dan Byman.
There are a couple issues when you look at that question. The first is the issue of numbers. A very American perspective is to say, you know, 60% of the country is Shia, 20% is Sunni Arab. Therefore, you know, 3-1. Okay, we're moving on. Numbers actually don't work that way in terms of warfare. You have many, many cases where the usual key is superior organization. And the Sunnis in Iraq have, at the moment, far better organization, far better training, are far better prepared for war. That diminishes over time because the Sunnis are mobilizing, or excuse me, the Shia are mobilizing. So in political science terms, there's a window where you have early attacks are better for the Sunnis because if a civil war is inevitable, have it today, not 10 years from now. The other is misperception. If you talk to many Sunnis, they will tell you that the elections were fixed because Sunnis are a majority, Sunni Arabs are a majority in Iraq. And what is this nonsense about a Shia majority? And although we laugh at that because we have the CIA fact book that can tell us the actual number, this is something that is actually widely believed and influences perceptions, which is that the disparity is not there the way we see it. And needless to say, this misperception is very strong among those who it matters most. A related point is contempt, which is a lot of these fighters look upon the Shia with contempt, that, you know, hit them hard, they will collapse. They cannot fight. They're not warriors. And we are.
True.
And again, this influences that decision. Now, you have these different strands within the Sunni community, part of which is using violence, I think, quite tactically. A little violence here, we strike a deal, the violence reduces, and so. But the problem with inviting the foreigners in and working with them is you lose control. You might be able to use violence tactically for your little cell, but the cell next to you is inciting a civil war, and you can't control it. And that, to me, is the problem for the Sunni Arab tribesman in Iraq, who is largely motivated by getting a better deal, is in order to push violence effectively, they've invited people in who have no interest in their agenda.
Okay. Yes. Melissa Maley, CNO Resources, unfortunately one of those counterterrorism analysts. First of all, I'd like to thank you for the presentation. It was very interesting, very informative. And looking at it from an American perspective, one of the things that we have looked at quite a lot was, first of all, we had not anticipated the degree to which Iraq would become a sanctuary for terrorism, and that it's now really fulfilling the role that Afghanistan played in the 1980s of being a source of inspiration, being a training ground, and being the ultimate network. And looking forward, taking into consideration the Sunni-Shia element that has truly risen quite to the forefront with the conflict in the current stage, looking forward to how this is going to evolve in the global jihad, do you see, would you anticipate moving to a new front, the global jihad, wherever that might be, and maybe you have some thoughts on that, or really is it going to get bogged down in this Sunni-Shia splinter? Will bin Ladens of the world, the ideological world, have the say to get, no, we need to unite and fight the far enemy, or will they bog down in their own more ideological disagreement?
Thank you. This was more or less what I tried to discuss in this other book called, in English, The War for Muslim Minds, but which in French was called Fitna. But maybe American publishers thought that such a word would be a catastrophe for sales, and they did not take Fitna, but The War for Muslim Minds.
You might think it has something to do with being fit.
Fitness. I mean, you know, it would sell like hotcakes on the on Key West, but unfortunately. And this fitna issue is a major issue, i.e. The problem with jihad is that when it is launched inappropriately, I mean, not at the right time, not by the right people, then it backlashes. against those who have launched it. And it's an issue of momentum. It's an issue of knowing your enemy and of tactics, of strategy. And there again, the Iraqi front is likely to become something that has to do with the Iranians, which is going to be a problem for the Sunnis, for the jihadis, for their backers, for the Saudis, for, you know, I mean, there is something, there is something very worrying which is opening now in Iraq. I mean, the Pandora's box has been opened, and it's not, obviously the vase of Pandora in English, the Pandora's box or vase? Pandora's box. It's an Italian place. The it's not going to close soon, I think. Now, in terms of what are the benefits of this jihad, of this anti-American jihad in in Iraq? As Zawahiri puts it, and Zawahiri is often a rather good analyst of geopolitics. I mean, I don't say that I agree with him, of course, but it's always interesting to try to see his accounts of things and of the balance of forces. And so he made, if I'm not mistaken, three infuriated declarations of late, saying that once again, as I mentioned before, the Muslim Brothers are the ones who are taking all the credit for it. And, you know, we started jihad. We were the ones who managed that there is such an antagonism, such a hatred for the West and for Americans in particular in the Muslim world. And this is all due to us. This should be put to our credit. But, you know, what have they done? They just opened the door for democratic elections, and to some extent in Egypt, to a large extent in Palestine, to quite an extent in Iraq, and who benefits from it? The Muslim Brothers. So, jihad, true jihad, is being betrayed. And even though this leads to a sort of a rising antagonism with the West, nevertheless, traitors have seized the opportunity to rise their own standards to the detriment of the true jihadists. And they're in a crisis, and hence this attempts to maybe to find another place than Iraq. Now, if you read Dan Pipe's literature, they found it in Europe, you know, while Europe slept, and whatever the Pipe's dream cottage industry, which is here and there, and where to read what he writes and his associates write, the you have the streets of Paris and the caves of Paris and the suburbs of whatever, of London, Amsterdam, are filled with jihadists who are going to destroy putrid and decadent Europe, babyless Europe and the like, and turn it into the next land for jihad. I think this is this has more to do with fantasy than with reality. But that does not exclude the fact that they are probably nowadays trying to not bet all they have on Iraq, because Iraq is in a way is turning sour, and the stakes are becoming too big for them, I would say.
Yes, please.
Sunny Efron with the Los Angeles Times. I'd like to bring you back, if I may, to the question of financing al-Qaeda. Has Zarqawi, to your knowledge, tapped into the money that Saddam Hussein had, that the Saddam Hussein loyalists presumably still control. And what do you make of the strange line in the Zawahiri Zarqawi letter exchange about send money?
Send me some cash. Send me 100,000, yeah. Mm.
And could you evaluate the U.S. strategy, the Treasury Department strategy for trying to shut down the terrorist assets? First of all, do you think it's succeeding? And second, do you think that money plays a major role in this, in continuing the struggle, or is the ideology basically self-financing that even, for example, if the U.S. or the West were to succeed in cutting off the access to funding, that it wouldn't affect the insurgency? Thank you.
Well, there again, if I were in a position to answer your question, I would probably be a U.S. Treasury General or something. unfortunately, I'm not. I was struck, as you were, by this strange line by the end of Zawahiri's letter, where he's, after he sort of chastised Zarqawi and said, you know, kill as many Shias as you want, but don't say it, and don't be so blatant, and stop this webcam, those webcam executions. It's no fun. It's not funny. And then finally says, by the by, could you hand some cash? And 100,000 would do. And I did not really know what to make of it. I mean, it would probably, as you rightfully suggested, lead to the fact that they are not denied of resources, and the fact that they have joined ranks with Sunni insurgents means that they have money. Because the Saddam Hussein groups or the Sunni bourgeoisie is not devout of funds and has looted the country for decades, so all this money has not evaporated. But more than that, it's difficult to say. I mean, you know, it's a low-cost jihad altogether. It doesn't cost much. The budget for the London bombing was a few thousand quids, and the Madrid operation was in the tens of thousands. So this is not of dollars or euros or whatever. So the this is not something where you need to have a major money laundering. I mean, a semi wealthy individual can be the financier. This may, but there again, this is only speculation, but this may be one of the reasons why, since 9/11, we haven't seen any operation on the same scale. 9/11 needed, the preparation for 9/11 needed massive money transfers, needed an organization, needed anticipation and the like. Things which, on a rather long time, things which may now not escape the scrutiny of the many agencies worldwide who are into looking at those things. The copycat bombings were on a much smaller scale. There are two ways to look at, to compare the 9/11, 3/11 in Spain, 2004, and what happened in London. One is the sort of optimistic, if I may say so, way, considering the number of victims and casualties by the thousands in America, by the hundreds in Spain, and by the tens in Britain. So you might conclude that, they are less and less able. But you can look at it the other way around, and this is far more problematic, because in the U.S., the 19, the magnificent 19, as they have it in jihadist circles, were all foreigners. I mean, there none of them was American-born, educated, or whatever. They just were thrown into the U.S. just like agents had been in the past. In Spain, it was a blend of Al-Qaeda people from outside and local Moroccan immigrants living in Spain who'd been picked up more or less at the last minute. which led to the fact that they were not really suicide operations. I mean, they were, the kids left their booby trap bags on the trains and then left because they had not been trained and like. And finally, they blew themselves up where they were surrounded by the Spanish police. But nevertheless, they were locals, even though they were not nationals. They were locals, which is much more a problem. And ultimately, Mohammed Siddiq Khan, the Leeds suicide bomber, was the quintessential son of British multiculturalism. And the and you probably see this this tape, the sort of jewel tape that was sent afterwards, where you have the Zawahiri's tape as an envelope, gives the sort of geopolitical legitimacy of the attack against Britain. And then you have the, within the envelope, you have the little tape by Mohammed Siddiq Khan with a thing over his head, speaking in a strongly accented Yorkshire English, which is his, has no other language, right? And saying, I can't really imitate it, and who would I be to dare imitate the English accent? But the this is war and I am a fighter, something like that. Yeah? And which, and you know, it doesn't need much cash, but to do that. But this is probably, it's much more problematic. I mean, because this is ideology, and this is something much more powerful than money. And, if you have access to locals who can sort of, you know, go anywhere, who have the identity in terms of identity cards and the like, just like, you know, this is the, one of the issue with the converts. Who are being more and more used as the tools. I mean, the famous Belgian Boulanger and the others, and that, that raises question also of social control. And, you know, this is one of the debates which is raging in Europe today. Is the Brits had their Londonistan model, i.e., that the community, quote unquote, was under the control of moderate Islamic leaders who would report to the police and check that peace and order be delivered. Leeds clearly showed the limitations of this model. Now, the French system has no such community thing, and the police and security forces have, who have had, unfortunately, more than 20 years' experience in this issue, have gone much deeper into the movement, and this, to a large extent, explains why France was spared from 2001. As neocons would tell you, that's because we're cowards and we are not in Iraq, and this is why. I don't think so, because we had the Veil affair, which is even worse than Iraq, and to their eyes. But I guess that this is largely because the police and the intelligence agencies have done far more in-depth work in those groups, and there is far less support in the sort of the wider Muslim community. But there again, I mean, I guess that the real battle is taking place there. I mean, I don't mean in Europe, or if it's in Europe, it's not lost, as Pipes said, it's in the making, and I think we'll win it. But the but it's an issue of how we win the battle for hearts and minds, and this is not only an issue of money. I mean, money is an issue, as the sort of panic about on the control of U.S. ports by Dubai Port Authority showed, you know, revealed of late. But it's not only that.
We just have 5 more minutes, so I would like 3 quick questions, please, and then brief answers from the panelists. Yes, but really no comment, just brief questions.
My name is Brian Hill from the Institute of World Politics. I have a question. You actually mentioned at the end of your last statement Hearts and Minds, which has come across. There's statements abound. Draining the Swamp is another. To what extent should the United States be treating this as more of a political conflict? The synergy between ideology and politics is it's self-evident. And the United States and its allies in fighting not only against Zarqawi and the Iranians in Iraq, but against terrorism abroad, be treating this less as a military conflict, less as an attempt to make friends in the Muslim world, but also, but instead, denigrate this sociopathic ideology of these terrorists. There's a word, I'm sure you're familiar with it, a haraba, the war against society in Arabic. That's one of the greatest sins. And
thank you. I'm going to take. Let's take all the questions together.
Hillel Fradkin of the Hudson Institute. Let me thank Gilles for a very generous talk. It was two talks. One was on Iraq, and one was on Al Qaeda. And I got a little confused along the way. So I just want to be very clear, although I think you've been clarifying it along the way. As far as Iraq is concerned, things are very, very bad for the U.S. But the main beneficiary looks like it'll turn out to be Iran. And as a result of which, it's very, very bad for Al-Qaeda. That it's really terrible for Al-Qaeda. And on that side, the main beneficiaries are let's put it this way, the Salafi wing of the radical movement. I wanted just to be, in the first place, clear that that's your opinion, and perhaps ask you where that goes, perhaps especially in light of a thesis I recall a long time ago that political Islam was dead, which was what had led, or Salafi political Islam was dead, and that's what had led to the resurgence of jihadi political Islam. Second thing, I just simply want to make a comment. You know, you may very well be correct that... actually, I have another question and then one comment. The question is, I wasn't quite clear why you thought the neocons would object to the publication of your book. Is it that you're publishing the documents, or is it that it's in French, a language they refuse to read?
Already, both.
Lastly... it may very well be true that Pipes is incorrect. Probably, if he were, he would. It's because he has not taken sufficiently into account the intelligence services, which you, in France at least, which you mentioned, nor the good sense of the French intelligentsia. What I recently noticed was their response to a plan to try to absorb more of the unemployed youth in the suburbs with some new labor law. I see that the French students, French intellectuals, French labor unions have embraced this plan with great enthusiasm.
Last question.
Yes, my name is Rashad Amir. I'm from the University of Maryland. Although very realistic, this division of the world between Sunnah, Shia, Kurds, Protestant is a flaw, is a vice in the European and American way of thinking the world. But to come back to this realistic flaw and vice, don't you think that the big man, Iran, that you called, have the right as a Shia identity to have his bomb, because, on the other hand, the Pakistanis, the Sunnis, have theirs?
Both panelists, take it right.
Well, I'll say something very quickly, and then leave the final word to Gilles, our guest here. I just think that, you know, in terms of what we call in the States blowback, This is major blowback in terms of Iraq, and it leads to the question of what we will do with Iran, given the present situation. And it is interesting to note that our own ambassador sitting in Baghdad has talked about six, seven, 8 weeks ago about initiating a dialogue with the Iranians. Now, that comes very late in the day, but if the analysis that Gilles presents suggests anything, it suggests that there has to be some sort of reviewing of our approach to the Iranians, given the kind of leverage they're going to have and already have in Iraq. So I just wanted to throw that out as a policy-relevant observation and turn the chair over to Gilles to help us finish up.
Thank you very much. I don't know how I'll manage with all those questions. The last one, i.e., whenever you go to Iran, I mean, one thing is clear, that even art secularists in Iran, the type who eat a mullah every morning for breakfast, sank in or cooked in wine, those people will tell you that they will die for the Iranian nuclear bomb. Because Iran, which is a 5,000-year civilization, is surrounded by lizard-eating Arabs, Pakistani bandits, Turkmen, peasants, and so on and so forth. So there is this feeling that, if only for defensive reasons, Iran has a right to have a bomb, because the among other things, not necessarily because the Israelis have it, but because the Pakistanis have it. And so, I don't know. I mean, we recently saw that President Bush offered a nuclear deal to India, but that means that, you know, the Indian government is deemed more reliable than the Iranian government for the time being. But this issue is not going to be settled with a no. There's no doubt about that. I mean, the Iranian nuclear issue is something that has to be negotiated, and to what extent is it possible to have an Iranian civilian nuclear system? Probably not with the mullahs, but in the future, I don't see how we could escape it. Then there was those very complicated questions by Hillel, but I have to deal with that. What was the first question?
The first question.
Yeah. Oh, about the war, yeah, war. Well, I think this is a very interesting issue. Actually, the maybe the mistake in the West, and particularly in this country, after 9/11, was to consider that this was a matter of war, and that war was the legitimate and the most efficient answer to the outsurge of terrorism. The war on terror was something that was started in a way to make a link between 9/11, Afghanistan, and then Iraq, because, you know, the natural outcome of the war on terror was Iraq, and as soon as the Saddam Hussein regime was toppled, now we don't hear of the war on terror anymore. It's not on the official agenda. There was something new that was coined, but it didn't work out. Project for the whatever. What is it? No, it's not. There's something against violent extremism. Something like PNAC or PNAD or FNAC or MNAC.
FNAC is the story.
No. This is something else. No. But something that was sponsored by the administration. Save, yes. But it's you know, the fact that we're with such an eminent people as you, we were at pains finding the acronym means that it's not really that popular, right? And struggle may be more significant than war, in terms of the means which are used, because it's not really an issue that the military can deal with. It's far more complicated, and it has to deal also with issues within societies for which the military are not equipped, including our societies. Definitely the sleeping Europe, but also the great awakening America. Now, to go back to Hillel's questions, You know, I tried to make an assessment of what I thought was happening in Iraq. And it may be a non-Euclidean assessment, that is to say, where parallels interfere with each other. I fear that what the Samarra bombing, anyway, the Samarra bombings were intended, the way I understand them, to preclude the co-option of the Sunnis into the Iraqi political system. That would put an end to the American dream to have the good, even the good insurgent Sunnis into the system, so that they would cut all ties with Zarqawi, and Zarqawi would be isolated. So now that the Sunnis are alienated because of the major Shia retaliation, there will be no Sunni co-option, and then there is no Zarqawi isolation from the mainstream Sunni insurgents. That's phase one, I mean, goal number one. But then there is an intended or unintended consequence, is that the more, as the gentleman said, one of the people who mentioned the fact that Sunnis, though a minority, were far better trained, equipped, were rich, and had this feeling of superiority on Shias. I think this is all very true. But then, now that you have Shias mobilizing, finally, then significant mobilization of Shias in Iraq, of Shias thinking that the U.S. cannot defend them anymore, and that the U.S. are now interested in having Sunnis in, and that they are not reliable, and so on and so forth, that opens an avenue for Iranian interference, which is already extremely significant in the ranks of the al-Sadr militia, and also in the Hakim group. And this may be, if you wish, a semi-unintended consequence. I mean, for the Zarqawi people, what is interesting is that the insurgent Sunnis are not going to throw them out now. I mean, they have, you know, they have secured, they have recovered their back on this issue. But in doing so, they may have opened the door for a major window of opportunity for the Iranians, something which, at the end of the day, will not, should not be great for the Zarqawi people, because then the conflict is going to take another nature, provided the U.S. still stays in the game, which may not be the case. I mean, in terms of physically staying in the game in Iran, but this is, you know, this is too far-fetched to decide on as of today. As of your other questions, I was just joking, of course, about the fact that publication of this book in French would be perceived as another sign that by the neocons that the French were really on the bad side, but we know that already. And what you said about what
authority is not there the way we see it, and needless to say, this misperception is very strong among those who it matters most. A related point is contempt.
In neighborhoods of outskirts of the big cities where we have projects, which are mainly peopled by families or semi-families, semi-families, because very usually the fathers are absent, more or less like what happens in African-American neighborhoods here, where kids mostly, predominantly from African origin, whether Black Africa or North African origin, set fires to cars in a sort of sacrificial manner after dusk to attract attention on their plight. And so this was diversely interpreted. Some said that it was the failure of the French model of integration. Others, Fox News had it that it was Fallujah on the Seine. I think the New York Times was the Third Intifada, and each according to his own series of fantasies. Dealing with my students and I went through the blogs that, you know, that insurgents or semi-insurgents, Fallujah French insurgents, had on the internet, and there was very, very little Islam in that. It was mainly things that had to do with respect, with torching more cars than the other city and the like. And at times you had a guy who started with, "Alhamdulillah, my brothers, don't burn cars, we have to burn the great evil of impious France," and whatever, but then he would be sort of brushed off by the others who said, "No, sucks, and we don't give, don't buy your shit." Or then you would have another guy, a leftist French, who you would identify because he would write in grammatical French instead of text French, mixed up with backslang and Arabic backslang, would say, "Comrades, do not burn the cars of your brothers in suffering, but go to Neuilly or to the posh neighborhoods and burn the cars of the capitalists." And there again, he would be, "Hey, bouffon, so dummy, get out, and we don't understand the language you talk," and the like. So it was more of a movement that was showing not only social deprivation, but also a feeling of racial and ethnic alienation vis-à-vis the mainstream that I personally interpreted as an attempt to join the mainstream and to join the fold. That is why there were a number of measures that were taken in order to try to facilitate their access to the job market. Now, the government measures that you so facetiously referred to, called the CPE, or the Contrat Première Embauche, the first job, whatever it is called, thing which is now leading to demonstrations, massive demonstrations in France, which is why I fled my country and tried to ask for shelter in the U.S., is not directly related to that. It is something that has to do definitely to this problem of having access to the job market for young people, but De Villepin sort of mistargeted the issue because students are not pleased because they're convinced that they can have access to a job for life and that they will not be fired, you know, when they have their first jobs. And this new job thing, allows the corporation or whatever to fire someone within 2 years without providing any explanations, any justification, in order to fluidify the job market. So, and the idea would be that, you know, as it's easier to recruit, then, you know, young people will have will break the first lock and then will be kept in the system. But then for the unemployed youth of the projects who have no qualification at all, usually this thing does not help because no one wants them on the job market, whether it be on a temporary basis or a non-temporary basis. So it has no real relation with the suburbs thing, much to our regrets.
Thank you very much. We couldn't help but end with a note regarding France, which was very nice. Thank you very much.
It's the center of the world. Yeah.